This interview is one in a series recorded by the Charlie Waller Memorial Trust as part of a Health Education England funded programme to transform outcomes for children and young people with extra vulnerability to mental health difficulties. The series includes interviews with a range of experts who each have specialist knowledge on the needs and experiences of a particular vulnerable group. This is an interview with Professor Tamsin Ford.
So do you want to just tell me who you are, please?
My name's Tamsin Ford. I'm a child and adolescent psychiatrist and I lead a small research group at the University of Exeter Medical School.
Thank you. Are conduct disorders a mental health problem?
That is a really interesting question. And we could talk for an hour on the philosophy of whether or not behaviour that challenges others should be conceptualised as a psychiatric problem. I'm going to sidestep that slightly to say that children who meet diagnostic criteria for conduct disorder, in other words, they have three or four severe problems that are repeated over time that are distressing people around them and are getting in the way of them accessing their education, maintaining friendships, family life, they have a much higher risk of every adult mental health problem that there is in the research literature. So this includes things like anxiety, depression and psychosis, as well as the things like substance misuse and alcoholism that perhaps might not be a surprise for children who've behaved badly. And I think because of that, having a category in which we can highlight children who are experiencing behaviour difficulties, even though it is a problem really for those around them, often rather than the children. If you talk to the children, they're often reasonably unaware of the impact their behaviour is having, particularly when they're younger. But having a category in which we can say these children are in difficulty seems to me very important, because if we can get in and find out why their behaviour is happening and to support them to change their behavioural traits, we may well be really impacting not only on their health trajectory, but almost certainly on their educational and employment outcomes and their intimate relationships and maybe their own children's mental health later down the line.
So how do we identify these children?
Again, that's a really good question. Often, children whose behaviour challenges, they declare themselves because somebody is struggling to manage them, be it their parents or carers or their teachers at school. I think the more important issue is understanding where the behaviour comes from. So there is a really, really strong overlap between children with behaviour problems and children with reading problems. And for those who hit the criteria for disorder in either category, it's about a third. So about a third of the children who have a specific reading disorder will also have conduct disorder and vice versa. There are children who maybe have a global developmental delay. So in other words, it's not so much that their behaviour is willfully bad, but it's that they are in a situation, particularly in a school setting, where actually the expectations are just inappropriate for their developmental level. And there are emotional disorders that can lead to behaviour that challenges. For example, if they have a child who is really anxious about being separated from a parent, getting them into school can be really hard, and that anxiety may manifest or be shown to others as temper tantrums and a refusal to go to school. Likewise, a teenager who is depressed can be really irritable, and they can not have the energy to do their schoolwork, and they may stop handing in their homework, and they may then be very bolshy and rude and irritable when challenged about that. So whenever a child's behaviour is challenging, it's worthwhile stopping and thinking why, what could be going on here, and thinking about children's broader mental health. Is there a neurodevelopmental disorder like ADHD or autism spectrum problem? Is in a teenager? Might they be depressed or might they be anxious about something? Or is there a learning problem that we haven't yet found out about? Or is there something going on at home, perhaps a divorce or a bereavement? Or is there bullying or something going on in the school context before coming back and thinking, well, no, this is only a behavioural problem, because it very rarely is.
Yeah. So when do you think it is important to have a diagnosis and why?
Well, diagnoses can bring access to resources that can support children. So if you assess a child and find that they have ADHD or an autistic spectrum condition, that can then translate into an education, health and care plan, which may translate into somebody to, say, support that child with autism in the playground or support that child with ADHD in the classroom to sit still and actually get some work done. So I think careful assessment is always important. And if there is a condition for which having a diagnosis or label would support that child to access support either within school or outside school, then that is one of the major reasons for having a diagnosis or a formulation so that that child can access the resources that they need. And I think it's more than just getting money to get a teaching assistant or whatever other support. It, in the eyes of the school and also sometimes the family, it changes a child who is a problem into a child that has a problem, which evokes a very different response from people around them. And that in itself, sometimes just the assessment and the explanation of what's going on and where this behaviour is coming from, can actually make a huge difference for everybody trying to work with this child and for the child themselves.
So what ways could we support, or might we support, children who are experiencing these difficulties?
Well, I think the first thing when faced with a child whose behaviour is challenging, either at home or at school, at both, is a clear assessment about what is going on and what might be happening. So that involves thinking through, how long has this been going on? Is this something that has trickled on for most of the child's life? Were they a toddler who was quite difficult to manage, who's turned into a teenager who's really harder to manage because they're bigger and there's more opportunity to do things that are challenging? Or is this a sudden change? And if it's a sudden change, what has happened that might explain part of that? What's going on in the environment, either at home or at school, that might be adding to this, both in a positive or a negative way? And particularly for children whose behaviour challenges, thinking, what are the situations in which things go right, and might those be possible ways of understanding what's going on, or perhaps also even levers for change? If there is another mental health problem like anxiety, depression, ADHD, all of those have evidence-based interventions that can help support the child, which will have an impact on their behaviour. And sometimes you have good going conduct disorder and any of those problems. So it's really worth doing a thorough assessment to make sure that everything is targeted to have the best outcomes for the child. So active remediation of learning problems, whole school approaches to behaviour for everybody are really effective, whole school approaches to bullying, and then simple and quite traditional techniques like having a daily report card that the child takes around the school with them, that then goes home, helps the communication. So it's not so much what's written on the card that counts, it's the fact that the child is aware that everyone's speaking to each other, and the fact that it opens up channels of communication. Having clear, realistic targets for what the child can succeed, and really praising success. I think what we're very good at is pulling people up when they fall down. And yet, you know, if we think of ourselves as adults, we make mistakes and we don't always behave by the highest standards. Whereas as a child, you're much more scrutinised. And if you get the reputation of being the child who always behaves badly, then you can get a sort of give a dog a name and hang it type phenomena, where there may be other children who are not quite so often behaving badly who just get away with it, and the child who's got the reputation for being bad is the one that's just cannot even breathe loudly, you know, they just get pulled up all the time. If you can reverse that so that you speak, you know, you really jump on the things that they do right and you give them lots of praise and lots of encouragement, again, that can be hugely effective in terms of turning the situation around, because they realise, actually, people do notice. They notice when I come to school and they notice when I hand my homework in and they notice when I do things right. And I think sometimes we forget to do that because we think, well, you just ought to. But actually, people don't do things that they're not motivated to. And the final thing is, when you're thinking about what is a reward for a child to reward positive behaviour, remember it's got to be a reward for the child and not the adult. So what the adult might think is a really good reward might not motivate the child because it's not what they're into.
I think we've got this written here, but I was thinking about the times when actually negative attention is better than no attention. And absolutely. Is that something that comes into play here?
It absolutely is. So, you know, you get back from people what you respond to. And I think what can happen in environments that are a little bit disruptive is that what is attended to is low-level disruptive behaviour, and therefore that perpetuates it, because, you know, the adult attention is hugely powerful for children and young people, and if they can't get positive attention for doing things right, then they will act up to get the teacher's attention, which becomes a very powerful tool, actually, because if teachers can organise their classrooms so that the disruptive people are where they can be kept an eye on, so that you can not necessarily ignore them. We're not saying, you know, don't just forget them. What we're saying is not attend to what they're doing, so you're aware of what they're doing, but you're not paying attention to it, whilst paying massive attention to the quiet, well-behaved children. That is very powerful in terms of bringing the other youngsters along with you, because they will want the attention, and if acting out doesn't get the attention, they will then start doing what is getting the attention.
So one of the other things just before we were talking about was we've got most children who are okay, and we've got some children who've got a real severity of difficulty at the top of that pyramid, and that somewhere in between we've got those children who sort of don't actually fit in either category. And what do we do with them? Because potentially they're the ones that aren't getting some of the traditional support.
Yes, I think, you know, the vast majority of children will go through their school career and develop into absolutely healthy adults without any major problems with their behaviour at home or at school, and indeed with their schoolwork, and they'll be absolutely fine at pretty much any school they went to. Then there are some really vulnerable children who, by virtue of having a learning disability and or their social situation and or their mental health, will never cope in a mainstream school, whatever support you put in. And for those children, I think it's really important that they're identified early and that they are moved to specialist provision because it suits their needs, not that they are left to fail in mainstream and then excluded, and then they end up in a specialist school because they failed in mainstream, because that in itself has an impact on people's mental health. And then between those two groups, you have a population of children who are vulnerable, and they're vulnerable to their home and school contexts. And that is where how schools are organised can make a real difference to the mental health and the educational outcomes of those children. And I think it's about having a really good whole school approach to bullying, to behaviour management, which is consistent, and there are similar messages that are put out to the entire school in terms of assemblies, in terms of rules, in terms of just how all the staff interact with each other and with other other students. And then problems are picked up early and supported as best they can be. And if it does look like a child cannot cope and the school cannot support, that an alternative provision is sought early rather than allowing the child to fail. And I think we shouldn't underestimate the importance of teacher-pupil relationships. So from the British National Survey data of school-aged children, we have demonstrated that teacher-pupil relationships, if poor, predict the new onset of behaviour problems and other psychiatric problems, and they also predict exclusions. So the flip side of that, and it was because of the questions that were asked, which weren't written by me, but the questions were asked, we could only look at bad teacher-pupil relationships. The flip side of that is what teachers and teaching assistants do is really important. And there is work from the 1970s that demonstrate for kids who are really vulnerable, so living in institutional care, having one interested adult who was often a teacher could make the difference between succeeding in terms of their mental health and their educational outcomes or not. So teacher-pupil relationships should be fostered to be as positive as they possibly can. And in terms of managing behaviour, the positive side of relationships is like putting money in the piggy bank, so that when you have to say, no, actually, that behaviour is unacceptable because, and as you did this, this is the sanction. If you have that good relationship, or you've spent time developing it, it won't damage the future relationship with the child, because those teacher-pupil relationships are really important.
Brilliant, thank you. Is there anything that I haven't asked you that you would ask yourself if you were me?
That's a really good question. I think it's very tough for teachers in schools. I think we know that managing children's behaviour is one of the things that teachers find the hardest about their job, and dealing with behaviour problems when teachers don't feel supported is quite often what causes people to leave the teaching profession. And I think teachers have quite high rates of depression and often feel unsupported, and I think we need to think about how we look after our teachers.
Thank you, Tamsin.
Thank you for listening. If you have found this resource useful, please consider making a charitable donation to CWMT by texting TALK18 and the amount to 70070. And to learn more about the work of the Charlie Waller Memorial Trust, please visit cwmt.org.uk.